This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's only a diary. Everyone knows diaries are just full of crap.
That's what Bridget Jones says. Sometimes they're full of that. Sometimes they're full of unexploded family landmines. What are you going to do with your diaries? What have you decided? Would you let your kids read them? And if not, what have you done to make sure that they don't? I'm Mary Guerin. This is the Conversation Hour. And I want to tell you, I came across an article in The Age today that reminded me of this diary dilemma I've contemplated for decades. I want to hear what you think I should do. Journalist Stephen Brooks' mum kept a diary about her swinging 60s travel adventures. He didn't want to read it, but his niece did, and she was horrified by some parts. Stephen Brooke will join me to talk about the sheer awkwardness that's been brought on by his mum's diaries. But I want to hear from you. Have you kept a diary of your secret scandals? What are your plans to do with them? Will you be a party pooper like Jane Austen, make sure they're destroyed? Or is that just better for all concerned? My journals did start off as exciting teen travelogues, but now they're just whinge fests. I only seem to journal when I'm sad or I'm stressed. Who wants to read that? Are yours the same? What should I do with my diaries? Tell me, have you ever reread yours? Have you ever read your parents'? I'd love to hear from you. Also, what role does your gender play, if any, when you vote? And what role does the gender of a political leader play in choosing who you are voting for? Today, I want to look at the role of gender, both as a voter and in political leadership, because noticeably in the stories about the rise of the One Nation vote is the role of women. Polling this week says One Nation now has more female supporters than men. Does that surprise you? And if so, why? What are the assumed roles of women in particular when it comes to right-wing populist parties? Today we're going to hear this is all part of an international trend. But I'd love to know what you think. Why are more women voting for One Nation? So tell me about what you'll do with your perhaps scandalous diaries. But next, what role does gender play for you as a voter?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Why do you think more women are voting for One Nation? And what is the role of gender for you in politics? I'd love to hear from you. My next guest has been looking at this and says it's part of a broader international trend that's seen female leaders and female voters become increasingly important to the success of far-right parties. Research fellow at the School of Government and International Relations at Griffith University, Dr. Sophia Amasari is with me. Sophia, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
You've written that this link between women and right-wing populist parties might raise some eyebrows. Why is that?
Yeah, because for some decades, women have actually been voting more for left-wing kind of parties, and they really steered away from the far right. Whereas now we see that this trend is not reverting, but it's changing a bit. So women are increasingly voting for far-right parties, not only in Australia, but actually many countries in Europe too.
Mm. And you also believe that women who join or support far-right parties do that for the same reasons as men. So does that challenge that assumption that women are naturally, if you like, quote-unquote, more moderate or progressive?
Yes, it does. So the expectation that I had precisely that the reasons were going to be different, they were going to be a sort of, you know, softer or more feminine version than men's reasons. But what I found instead is that the reasons why women support far-right parties are really the same as men. So it is a matter of expressing your dissatisfaction with the performance of mainstream parties. It is a matter of cultural grievances against groups like, you know, immigrants, ethnic minorities and refugees. And it is a matter of economic grievances.
Mm. So part of the widespread dissatisfaction with major parties is what you would pin it down to. Doesn't matter about gender.
No, gender doesn't matter there. So both women and men are voting for One Nation because they want to express disillusionment with Labour, with the coalition, and the way they handle the cost of the living crisis.
1300 222 774. What do you think about this move by more women towards One Nation? Why do you think that's happening? And are you more or less inclined to vote for a party led by a certain gender? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. With us is Sophia Amasari, who's been looking at that across the world. Sophia, you've been looking at this trend across the world when it comes to far-right parties. You point out that there are female leaders of many of these parties, but you view it through a certain lens of where these women are coming from, the sort of roles that they assume. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, what's interesting about, One Nation and a handful of other far-right parties in Europe, it is that it's led by women, which is a bit counterintuitive given the very traditional gender roles that these parties promote. But then if you think about the kind of women leaders that are leading these far-right parties, we have obviously Pauline Hanson, but she founded her own party. Same with Giorgia Meloni, the current Italian prime minister in Italy. She founded her own party, Brothers of Italy. Marine Le Pen, her father founded Rassemblement National in France, but then she kicked him out over 10 years ago. So, they didn't have to climb up a party hierarchy, if that makes sense. And then we have also Alice Weidel. She's the co-leader of the Alternative for Germany. But again, Germany is kind of an interesting case because they're a dual model of leadership with one woman and a man is very common. So, yeah, they didn't have to face, the kind of toxicity, masculinity, man-dominated environment that usually political parties provide to women.
We're talking about the polling that this week came out from Resolve that said that more women than men are now supporting, should I say, One Nation as it enjoys this rise. Sophia, are we witnessing women moving towards the far right in that circumstance overseas or towards the right-wing populist parties? Or are we witnessing those right-wing parties becoming something different? Which is the movable part of this equation?
I think that's a very good point. And I think it is primarily a matter of these parties becoming increasingly legitimized. And in that sense, gender plays a card too, because we have political science research, including my own research, showing that women leaders can make the far right look more legitimate. So, for example, I conducted an experiment with a colleague, Dr. Yasin Off, from the University of Hamburg in Germany, in which we found that if a woman far right leader makes anti-immigrant statements, she will still be seen as more socially acceptable by the public than if a man does. And that goes back to those, gender stereotypes that we were talking about before. So people tend to ascribe more feminine characteristics to women, like that, they are more moderate, they are more cooperative, they are more empathetic. And so the same anti-immigration message is perceived differently by the people if it comes from a woman or a man.
So, that's interesting. So that's about the female leader packing the same message as a man but being seen as more respectable. In a way, is that just patronising?
I think it's just a perceptual filter that we use all the time. I would say it's just a mechanism that we use psychologically, just attributing feminine characteristics to women and masculine characteristics to men.
You're listening to Sophia Amasari on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Tell me what you think. This from Annette on text, Sophia. Female leaders here normally get more scrutiny, abuse, sexism, etc., and suggests that Pauline Hanson seems to escape this from her supporters. That's Annette's point. You're talking about respectability and even, I guess, a bit of a a bit more lenience towards the messages from women. But what about the other side of that ledger? Don't female leaders get more scrutiny or abuse or sexist pushback?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the same in Australia as in any other countries. Women leaders are just harder time than men leaders because they are still perceived, despite decades of progress, as not really belonging to politics, and politics is still pretty much seen as a men's realm. So that will be the case for women leaders on the left, on the right, it doesn't matter.
In your studies, you were talking about this being about frustration with the major parties, and we've seen that across the spectrum, you know, whether it's left to right, if you want to take those terms into account. But to what extent do policies matter then? Are we seeing then that it's about right or any sort of party taking on more issues that are going to attract female votes? So, for instance, women-specific issues, or are those going to be the issues that in the end women might look askance at?
Sorry, what's the question?
Fair enough. That was long, wasn't it?
Yeah.
To what extent do the policies of these parties change or not change then for women to attract women?
Right. They change very little in the sense that, you know, they continue to promote their very traditional gender ideology. But what's interesting is that although policy doesn't change, their rhetoric might do. So, for example, I'm taking the European experience here. We know that when far-right parties are not doing very well electorally, especially among women, they will adopt what is called a femo-nationalist rhetoric. So, you know, they will portray immigrants, and especially Muslim immigrants usually, as being a threat to women, as being a threat to their rights, as being a threat to gender equality. So no change in policies, but they might try, you know, to portray themselves as the saviors of women from immigrants.
Mm. Sophia, it's fascinating to me. And of course, as the world goes on, and we will see what happens both overseas and here with those trends. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Sophia Amasari, who's Research Fellow at the School of Government and International Relations in Griffith University, talking about the role of gender, whether it comes into play for you as a voter or whether you're voting for a certain gender as well in terms of a leader. Lindy is saying, for me, it's akin to going to a male doctor and expecting him to understand my period pain. He may be empathetic, though honestly, he's got little idea of what I'm experiencing. Same with politics. However, I'll never vote for One Nation. Ignorance and bigotry scares me witless. That's what Lindy has to say. Let me know what you think as well as we continue throughout the conversation hour. But also this hour, I'm asking you because I need to know for myself, what are you doing with your diaries? Coming up very soon, we're going to be talking to journalist Stephen Brooke, who tells us about his awkwardness when he discovered his mum's diary. What have you been doing? What are you deciding? Megan, in Q, what do you think about diaries?
Well, it's a mixed bag because I do love reading literary published diaries. My first one was Lady Tennyson's diary, and she was the wife of the first Governor General. I think it was the Governor General, or it might have been the Governor of Victoria. And it read like a book, and it had been put together. Whereas when my mother died 30 years ago, I found her diaries, which had very little in them except what they'd had for dinner that night, what she cooked. And my brother asked me to get rid of them, so I did. I put them in the recycling, actually. But I think, for me, I keep a diary, and I keep them, but I want them to go when I go because they're not of any interest except to me. And, of course, you put things in code anyway. You don't put, for instance, you go to the National Gallery. You don't put, I went to the National Gallery to see Bligh. You put NGV. And it might be a tick or something like that.
You don't think
there's usually a code.
Yeah. And but you don't think, at that point, though, it's in someone else's hands whether they're going to destroy them, isn't it, Megan?
Well, the other option is to get rid of them before you go.
Do you think you can do that?
I'm 81, so I can think about that. I've kept them because occasionally something will come up. Where was I in 1985?
Okay.
September or something like that.
And what do you feel when you reread them?
Well, they do remind you of a few things.
Any scandals? Any scandals you need to go through with the texture?
No way. Okay. I think you don't put scandals on paper if you don't want to share them, do you?
Oh, Megan, there you go. That's your method. Use code, don't put down the scandals. Let me know what you do. Thank you, Megan. Anna, you've called in from Mornington Peninsula. Hello. What do you do with your diary?
My diary. It's not so much diary. I started as a typical teenager when I was 16 and had a couple of years go at writing diaries, but then from 18, I just kept writing. So it's been going now for 58 years.
Wow. What do you put in there, Anna?
Well, it started off as sort of just trivia, went to and did such and such, but it's sort of over the first few years, it then developed into a little A4 book. So I just buy the A4 so they all fit together on the same shelf. I've managed to squeeze them all on a shelf at the moment.
And would you mind if someone else read them?
No, not really. They've been extremely useful for rather serious things, like we had an audit and the gentleman who was quizzing my husband said, you know, where did you get such and such money from? And he was able to say I was working overseas and I had traveler's checks and things that he'd been given.
Mm.
Small family disputes, we did such and such on a certain day and no, we didn't. We did it until the year before and we were able to sort things out.
So no scandals.
You know, it's a no scandal. It's a reference more than anything.
Yeah,
it's been very interesting. And as I said, I've kept it every day except for a couple of weeks when I was really very ill.
For 58 years. That's got to be a record. I wonder if we have records for this. But Anna, I reckon that you could win that.
I like the period around Samuel Pepys, and I think I've probably surpassed him by a few months, you know.
Anna, thank you. Have you beaten Anna? Can anyone beat that? A diary pretty much every day for 58 years. Wow, that is dedication. And what do you put in it? Is it like me, just full of whinging at the moment, or do you have a diary that someone else can read, have a bit of an insight into your life? Or do you want that to happen? If not, how are you going to get rid of them? I'd love to hear from you. Next, we'll hear what one journalist found and was fearing when he saw his mum, somewhat scandalous, diary.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Stephen Brook, who's special correspondent for The Age, who wrote this article. It appears today in The Age. It reminded me that I still haven't made the decisions about what I am going to do with my diaries. Stephen, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
Yeah, good. Thank you. I loved your article. Your headline is, "I Thought I Knew Awkward, Then Mum Published Her Swinging 60s Travel Diary." How did you come to know of and start to read your mum's diary?
Well, it was on the bookshelf upstairs where a lot of books were, and I found it. I was only a kid, right? I was like probably at primary school.
Mm-hmm. Just looking for something to read.
Well, yes, and I thought, oh, what's this? And it was very neat cursive writing, very sort of closely packed, and I realised that it was a travel diary that my mum had started in 1964 when she was 24 and she had got a ship from Australia to Britain and had worked there for 2 years as a supply teacher and then backpacked around Europe and also to Africa. And I recognize I didn't read very much of it. I glanced through a few pages, but who wants to read, you know, cursive handwriting? And I realized there was a name in there who was a friend of my mother's, Pamela, whom we had all met. And then I just thought, I really don't want to read this. I don't want to know. And then I left it and forgot about it. And I'm told and retold a lot of stories from that era to me and my brother, but also my brother's daughter, her granddaughter. And then one of these stories was about backpacking and hitchhiking through Europe. And Letitia, her granddaughter, said, "But what's hitchhiking?" And then my mum explained it, and Letitia, who is from Gen Alpha, was horrified at this whole idea. And mum said, "Well, you know, you get in a car with strangers." And Letitia's like, "But you don't know them."
So that was the thing that horrified Letitia. I want to know if you have read, been able to read your parents' diaries. Did you discover anything more horrifying than hitchhiking? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Would you want your kids to read your diaries? If not, what are you going to do about it? So then you've actually published your mum's diaries with a little bit of editing. Is that right?
Well, I, despite being the journalist in the family, had no role in this. My sister-in-law found a program that online that you could get it published. It's available on Amazon, and you can. And then she got photos put in. It's incredibly professional, and so it was kind of like a lockdown project almost. Catherine's like, "Would you like to type up these written diaries, put them in digital form?" And my mother thought, "I want my granddaughter to read what life was like back then, and the freedoms that we had, and how we went travelling." Because, of course, we live in such a globalised society. Travel is nothing new to our children and grandchildren, right? They've been travelling since they were babies. But this form of travelling, where you would go to youth hostels or you would camp, seems to be a vanishing thing, particularly with the young.
Yeah.
So that was really what motivated my mother to publish them.
So insight into another world, really.
Totally, but, yes.
But I thought it was funny when your mum said, "Oh, I only included one of the other marriage proposals that I got."
Well, that was the shock for me, right? Because who wants to read about your mother being proposed to in Trafalgar Square in the middle of London by a guy who is not your dad, which was in her diary. And she's called it almost an odyssey, right, because of the, you know, relationship with ancient Greece. And and then so that was the surprise for me. And I thought, I don't want to know any more.
I still don't want to know any more, even though it's in print.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
So, but it was just when I thought, I got to ring up and tell her that I'm writing this up.
Yeah.
Just as a courtesy. And then typical mum, she's like, "I don't like the photo that you're going to use." But then
it's
right,
tell her she's beautiful. Yes.
Yeah, no, it's great, isn't it?
Anyway. Yes.
I lost out on the book cover because she went against my advice. And I'm like, "I'm only the journalist here, Mum. I do this thing for a living."
Oh, I actually thought it was a pretty good one too. I agreed with you, Mum. I liked it. It's just a little bit, you know, a little bit different. Are you like Stephen? Were you shocked and appalled if you have read your parents' diary? 1300 222 774. Sue in Hepburn, what did you want to say? Hello, Sue.
Hi, sorry.
That's okay.
Yes, I think diaries are very important historic documents for a period of time. My family inherited my great-great-grandmother's, my great-grandmother's and my grandfather's diaries.
Wow.
Going back to 1800. They're now residing in the Auckland Archive. But the thing I wanted to say is, in a number of years ago, I did a presentation on my grandfather's life. He was Lord Baden-Powell's first Scout Commissioner in 1908. He fought in the First War. He was an airman. He was a prisoner of war for 3 years. He went to fight the White Russians, as he learned Russian when he was a prisoner. Went on to build Treetops Hotel in Kenya.
So fascinating. And so obviously all of these diaries are written as almost as historical documents. Sue.
Some of them are, yes.
I have a feeling that's how it was done those days. None of this angsty journalism, journalizing.
They're very much more factual, not so much feelings. Except my great-grandmother's, there were some beautiful little ones when I did a presentation on my on my grandfather's experience of a prisoner of war, I was able to take her point of view and take snapshots of her diaries. She had four sons at the war, and when she got bad news in the top of her little diary, she'd put a black cross. And when she got good news, she'd put a sun.
Oh.
And she had one son killed, three sons eventually prisoners of war, some wounded. You know, so you can imagine the angst for a woman. And we so often miss out on the woman's part of history.
That's true. That's true, Sue. Thank you so much for telling us that story. I do have some texts that echo that. It's seeming like there are a lot of women are keeping those diaries. And this on text, we have our grandmother's diaries. It's so good to find some details from the past. I read the other day an account of my third birthday party, and I am now 74. That is absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
Stephen Brooke is with you, special correspondent from The Age, whose mum, you know, let an awkward diary get into the hands of her grandchild. Stephen, just that idea of how we've kept diaries changing over the decades, really, the centuries. You were writing about the awkwardness of when women, in, I guess, or just mothers, fathers, whatever, are talking about them being so young. It's really just that jarring nature. But again, that's valuable, isn't it?
Well, we all tend to think that we were the first generation that went out partying and went drinking, and we sort of did this in the shadow of our disapproving parents who would keep an eye on the clock and insist on we getting home at certain times and things. And guess what? They were in their own era and version doing precisely the same thing, and were meeting people and getting boyfriends and girlfriends and going traveling and drinking alcohol in bars. A lovely comment that I got from one of the readers of The Age said that he had and his brothers had discovered their very stern father's diary when he had been 24 or 25 traveling around the world, and they said it was very hard to reconcile with their stern father, this very young alcohol drinking skirt chasing man. So maybe we do change over time, and that's what we're really doing. We're just capturing a little moment in time that might seem to be mundane to us when we're writing it down, but then guess what, if there's 50 or 60 years that pass, suddenly that is of intense interest for a life and a world that has often completely vanished and been upended.
Has it made you feel differently about keeping a diary? Do you keep a diary?
I don't keep a diary, but then I realized I kind of do in a way, and I just wanted to put this out to your listeners in that I correspond at length with quite a few friends around the world on messaging services. And I had cause to look back at some of those messages that I'd sent from, you know, about 5 years ago. And I thought, this is almost like a diary. It's obviously
the new diary
to someone. But there's quite a lot of detail about what my thoughts and feelings were like at the time and who I was friends with and how life was going. So I wonder if the kind of friend or family group chats, where there's a lot of input from different people, are becoming the new diary.
Absolutely.
But then it can be pretty personal and it can be pretty private depending on who the conversation is with. But you scroll back, it's all recorded there.
Yeah, and potentially you've got way less control in terms of whether that's kept. Scott, you're in Edenhope. Do you keep a diary?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 46 and I've kept a diary since I was 16.
Oh, great. Every day?
Yeah. Every day, believe it or not. Yeah.
What do you write about?
I generally write about what I do during the day. So really just my, I'm a farmer. I'm a farmer at Edenhope. So I generally write, moving sheep and spraying paddocks and the like.
Is there an audience in mind, Scott?
My children. Right. My children. Yeah, we've got four children. My oldest is 10 and my youngest is 2. Two boys and two girls, and that's the main reason I do it, because my father used to keep a diary, and my grandfather used to keep a diary as well.
Oh, that's fantastic. Does that mean that you haven't put any scandalous secrets in there?
it's a very good question. Should I say, if I realised I was going to keep a diary for so long, then I may have changed some information in the diary.
You can go through and put it into code, potentially.
Yeah, that would involve scribbling. It's very old-fashioned. It's very obviously it's a handwritten diary. I did use different programs and things on my phone and apps, but it just didn't feel the same.
Oh,
as opposed to pen and paper. So,
Scott, I'm so admiring of that and your dedication, and it's such a gift to give to future generations.
Scott, what I would love to ask you, Scott, is the day that you met your wife, did you write about that, and would you show your children that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so it was a good story.
A wonderful thing for them to read when the time is right.
I think so. I mean, my oldest, he's 10. I mean, obviously he can read. So, I would assume that they would get the same experience that what I did reading my father's diary.
Oh, Scott, that's actually great. I feel a lot of gratitude on behalf of your kids to be able to get all of those generations coming in. So, Stephen, I think you should start potentially now. It's not too late.
No one is going to be able to read my handwriting, Mary.
That's another point. Stephen Brooke, thank you so much for joining us on the Conversation Hour today.
Take care, Mary.
That's Stephen Brooke. And for our 774 listeners also, you can hear Stephen on Drive this afternoon with Charlie Pickering on Friday Flashback at 3:30. This on text, I just burnt my diaries from my younger self. I did not want my children to have to read them. This as well. I wish we could still have incinerators to burn those diaries. That's from Annie. Shred diaries they are, and they should stay private. Well, we seem to have a bit of a theme here. Also this from Sharon. Approximately 4 years ago, I lost my partner of nearly 30 years. In our years together, we had wonderful communication. Since his death, I have written to him in my diaries every day, telling him all the news in the family and around the world. I do believe this has helped me cope with his death. It's like speaking to him again. Best wishes, Sharon, and I'm really happy to hear that that is helping you. Keep those calls and texts coming about diaries. We will continue the conversation. Also, though, it's coming up to the long weekend, and we wanted to see what was happening with our national parks, because this week there have been fears that dozens could be affected or even closed. We wanted to get to the bottom of that gear, get a clearer picture of what's happening. But next, if you're heading for the snow instead, we'll talk about how to stay safe.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
What is happening with the snow? With a lot of crazy weather, I've seen that there have been great dumps out there on the Victorian snowfields. How do we stay safe? Celeste Young is Collaborative Research Fellow of the Risk Disaster and Resilience Network at Victoria University. Thank you, Celeste, for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Generally speaking, how aware of risks in the snow are people? It's an annual story. Do people keep the lessons that they hear or they learn?
I think because risk is something you learn through experiencing it, and going to the snow, Australia's not a country you associate with being very cold in. So it's, unless you've been up there, unless you've experienced it, you probably wouldn't understand what the risks are. For people who go up there regularly, yes, they're aware of their risks and how to manage them and how to prepare.
And what are your top tips for how to prepare in particular?
Well, I think the most important things are check the weather forecast, make sure you understand what sort of conditions you're going to be driving in and arriving at. So it can be lovely and sunny in Melbourne, and if you think, oh, it's great, let's go to Mount Buller for the day, you can get up there and it can be really cold, it can be cloudy, it can be windy. So you need to check the weather forecast for your timing. Might mean you leave a little earlier if you know things are coming in the afternoon. You need to pack really good clothes, make sure that you've got waterproof clothes and that they're warm. And always take a change of clothes in case something happens and you get wet, because it's not like you can just pop out to Kmart and grab something while you're up there.
No, they don't deliver up a mountain. We should remember that. And, of course, you talk about preparing for the weather that we can, that is predicted or that we can know about. But last year we saw on Mount Hotham a sudden snow form and there were dozens of day trippers stranded in their cars. So do you always have to also think about the worst possible scenario?
Look, I think you need to be aware of what can happen. You do have to prepare your car. You have to have safety chains in the snow. In the case of last year, people decided it was up in the Dargo Plains and they went up a sidetrack, and yes, they did get stuck. And even for experienced people rescuing them, it was quite challenging. You also need to make sure you've got antifreeze in your car and that you've got the proper alpine fuel if you've got a diesel car. So all of this information is online. You really need to prepare and go in and have a look, see what you need to do before you get up there. Because once you're up there, there's, you know, rescuing people is a different proposition up there to being in the city.
Mm. You're on The Conversation Now, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Are you heading towards the snow? How are you preparing? 1300 222 774. Celeste Young is with us, giving us a few tips. I believe you've seen people who have really not done their preparation. What's kind of the worst thing that you've seen, Celeste?
Oh, gosh. Well, when I was up there last time, there was somebody in runners with little thin socks and shorts on, and they were having an absolutely miserable time. The other thing you can see is that people sort of turn up and they're not aware of the environment, so they'll go into the middle of the ski field where you've got people traveling very fast down and sort of wander through it. You really need to be aware that this is a different environment and that things can happen. Someone did tell us of a family having a picnic in the middle of the ski run, for example.
What?
So
in the middle of the ski run?
Yes. So there are things that people aren't aware of, that it's not a normal environment. So always go to things like tobogganing, for example, is fabulous fun. But they now have allocated spaces for that where you've got people around who can help you and make sure you do it safely. And there's lots of people peppered around the different resorts and sites that you can approach if you've got a question about what to do. The other thing too with the snow chains is make sure you give yourself enough time and that you know how to put them on properly, because otherwise you can spend a lot of time trying to get them on and off, and that's not something you want to do.
We're talking about the snow season. Are you planning to go there, and what have you seen up there on the slopes when it comes to risk? Celeste, I've also been reading that because of climate change and El Nino, even though we've seen this snow arriving now, that we could be in for a slushy snow season. Mm-hmm. What sort of risk does that present?
Look, slipping and falling, just walking around, can be a lot more dangerous. And also, if it suddenly freezes, you'll get lots of ice. But driving up in that, there's a couple of things. The roads can be slippery, and also the roads can you can get bogged, which is something you really do not want to do going to and from. And that's why it's always really important too to make sure you've got like a first aid kit, you've got lots of food. Food is really important because your body burns more fuel in the cold. Make sure you've got lots of food and you're not tired when you're driving up there and walking around.
Yeah. And one thing also that I've noticed when I ever take my phone into these environments, that can really drain a battery. What would be your tips when it comes to phones?
Well, there's two things you need to do. The first thing is turn on a location tracker and keep it close to your body. Keep it warm, because it will give you false signals too. If it gets too cold, it doesn't like the cold and it doesn't like heat.
Celeste, thank you for your tips. I'm sure that many people will be much happier on the slopes listening to you.
Well, my pleasure. And it's beautiful up there. So I hope people, if they go up there, they think about it and they have a great time when they get there.
Indeed. Celeste Young is Research Fellow of the Risk Disaster and Resilience Network at Victoria University. You're on the Conversation Hour. We are talking soon about something else you might be doing at the long weekend, going to national parks. There's been some talk this week about what effect, if any, the industrial action from rangers and staff employed by National Parks, so Parks Victoria, might have. We will get to that. Also, we're talking about diaries, dilemmas about keeping them or reading them, if you're reading your parents' diaries. When my mum passed away last year, my father found himself reading her diaries from 60 years back when they married. He found himself questioning himself as a husband and father. And this, my mum found a diary in her cookbook collection she'd forgotten about, and one page she read out was an in-depth story about the birth of my younger sister. We were all sitting in the kitchen crying. It was beautiful. Lots of other texts as well, talking about why you have kept them away or why you have destroyed them. But next, what is going to be happening in our national parks and campgrounds in Victoria this long weekend?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, this week there have been fears that dozens of national parks in Victoria would be affected by industrial action being carried out by the AWU, Australian Workers Union, and that is rolling work stoppages and periodic bans and so forth. Parks Victoria today has told the Conversation Hour that all parks will be open as usual. So we thought we'd check in with the AWU and see exactly what is the go. Ross Kenner is Victorian Branch President of the Australian Workers Union. Thanks for joining us, Ross.
Thanks for your time, Mary. Thanks for the opportunity.
What will people going to national parks see this weekend? How will it be affected by industrial action? And is Parks Victoria right? They'll all be open as usual?
Well, we acknowledge that Parks Victoria have put out a statement claiming that all parks will be open. The AWU members involved in the industrial action will be continuing that industrial action. So they will have rolling stoppages throughout the parks throughout the weekend. This will mean that we believe that the parks may be unsafe. The only way that we could envision that they would have people there is if members of another union cross a picket line, which we're very hopeful they won't do.
Is that the CPSU?
That is the union who seemed to have withdrawn their protected action that was going to work alongside the AWU on the weekend. We believe they've notified parks that they will withdraw their industrial action, which we're really, really disappointed with. This is an opportunity to show some solidarity across all the work cohorts at parks and actually make sure that parks comes to the table for a fair deal.
Right. So let's get into what you were saying there. You're suggesting to people listening at home now that they're planning their trips to parks, that if that they're planning to go, even if they're open, they may be unsafe. What do you mean by unsafe?
Our members do all the work within the parks. So our members are the front-facing rangers who do all the work. That means that the parks will be unattended for periods of time while the protected action is in place. We have certain bans in to put pressure on the employer to come to the party and actually pay these workers properly.
But what exactly would be the safety risk that you're pointing to?
Well, the reason we have rangers is to make sure that campers and the general public are safe whilst they're in the parks. There are rescues that happen. There are all sorts of stuff that happen when people are in the bush that will be impacted by the industrial action.
So no rescues? I'm just trying to drill down. If someone's making a decision right now as to whether they're going or not, what are you suggesting will not be available for people there?
We'd hope the general public will support the rangers and not go to the parks. This is very much a case of the employer forcing this.
But if they're trying to weigh the risk for themselves, are you suggesting that there will not be rescues in parks in Victoria this weekend?
I'm suggesting that the Parks Victoria will have to manage that, and I'm not sure. I'm not part of their risk management assessment team, so I've got no idea exactly what they're planning. But I do know that the trained people will be doing industrial action, and typically if trained people are the ones that do the work, they tend to be the ones that can do the job safely and do it properly. So I'd be are looking, making a real decision if you're a member of the general public, do you want to enter a park and cross a picket line, with Parks Victoria just being truculent now and not coming to the party and not actually doing, negotiating in good faith and getting a deal done.
So you're suggesting that anyone who goes to a park is crossing a picket line. Isn't that a bit unfair? These are people who are, you know, have been planning their holidays for a long time. What would you have to say to them if they're thinking, look, I appreciate your cause, even support your cause, but, you know, we want to have our holidays, and if it's open, we trust Parks Victoria?
And that's each individual has to make that assessment. What I'm saying is the reason we have some of the best parks in the world is because of the staff that actually maintain, build the roads, do all the work that makes our parks workable for the general public. Without these trained people in the roles, the parks will turn really quickly. We know that. These people love their job. They love being out in the bush. They love doing what they do. They need to be rewarded for that. They are not classified correctly, they're not paid correctly. And as a fighting union, we will continue to fight for our membership and try to make sure that they do get what they deserve. I'm hoping the Victorian public will be calling the Minister's office, calling Parks, and letting them know that, you know, this is unacceptable. These workers who make the bush workable for Victorians need to be paid properly, need to be make sure that they can do their job safely, and they can only do that if they're not worried about how, where their next pay packet's coming from and how they're going to pay bills and stuff like that. The parks are for everyone, and they should be maintained properly by the government, and that includes making sure that the workers are well paid and can actually do their jobs to the best of their ability.
And that's the nature of your negotiations that you've tried to go through with. Ross, we will be talking soon to someone from the Victorian National Parks Association about the importance of rangers, but just as a final question, if people want to know which parks might be affected, is there somewhere they can go to look at a list?
Yeah, look, we know that the Herald Sun published a piece the other day. We know not everyone has access to the Herald Sun. That's behind a paywall. We will maintain where we believe the action will take place on the Australian Workers Union Victorian branch social media. So if you look up AW Victoria on any of the social media apps, you'll be able to see rolling stories and updates on what's happening with the park rangers. And we'd love for the Victorian public to actually show our rangers the support. They're taking a massive step. This is, you know, they don't do this lightly. They are really trying to get a deal done here, and we are still hopeful that Parks will come to us today and you know, actually work with us and give us something to take back to members.
Right. So there's still a chance this could be called off by the end of today.
Yeah, look, my phone's on, our organisers' phones are on, our secretary's phone's on. They can call us anytime they want and try to get a deal done. It's on Parks now to come to the table. They know what we've been pushing for. We've been very clear on how it's compliant with the wages policy. It's on Parks Victoria now to do the right thing, pay their workers properly, and make sure this strike doesn't happen.
Ross, thank you for your time today.
Thanks very much for the opportunity, Mary, and have a great weekend.
You too. Ross Kenner is AWU organiser, and Jordan Crook is from the Victorian National Parks Association. Jordan, I just wanted to talk to you because your organisation supports national parks and also the staff as well. Wanted to get from your point of view what the bottom line is here in terms of the importance of this issue when it comes to the national parks.
Yeah, I guess there seems to be an ongoing attack on national parks and wildlife in Victoria by this Allan government. We were actually in Parliament yesterday launching a new Nature Alliance to push back against these cuts. Over 55 million people visit our national parks every year, but they get less than 0.5% of the state budget. So we need to resource our parks better. And like Ross said, we have some of the best national parks in the world, and we need to look after them.
There seems to be a muddied picture about exactly what any one particular visitor might find when they go into these campsites, at least as it stands right now this afternoon. How important are those rangers? How important is it with this industrial action when it comes to people's safety this weekend?
Yeah, a lot of the work that park rangers do isn't necessarily seen as such. It can be from maintaining facilities, keeping tracks open and the like, but also managing visitor pressure in the parks as well. Lots of people are going to be visiting the parks, so we need to manage that impact across the whole parks to make sure it doesn't damage the parks that we're all trying to visit because of their beauty.
Jordan, thank you so much for your time and have a really wonderful long weekend.
You too. Get out into the parks, but maybe next week.
Okay. That's the message from Jordan Crook, Victorian National Parks Association. Still a little bit of a murky picture there. So the call from Ross Kenner is to check out the AWU social media to see potentially how your plans might be affected this long weekend. And a reminder, I will be here on Monday. It's not a long weekend for us and this team. We love being with you, so we will be here. We have been talking about diaries, what you do with them. Someone has written in saying that they share my dilemma about diaries, saying, this has been my private dilemma for years. I have kept a diary for 40 plus years. As I get older, I wonder what to do with them because I feel they're quite boring. But as someone said, it's been fabulous to be able to look back and to see what happened at a certain point. Also recall things about my kids when they were young. But as I get closer to 70, I think I'll have to ask one of my children to burn all my diaries if I suddenly fall off the perch. And then I wonder, I agree with you, anonymous texter, but will they actually go through with my wishes? Jeff says, never record anything you don't want used in evidence against you. And others who say, I can't beat 58 years, as one of our callers said, but I've kept mine since 1973 when I was pregnant with my first child. Yes, kudos to everyone who kept diaries when they had children. I started, honestly, I didn't follow through. I wish I had. Join me again on Monday. I will be here. We will all be here despite the public holiday. It'd be great to talk with you then about your weekend. Catch you then.